Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to Justice, a podcast series exploring all aspects of the criminal justice system with me, prison philanthropist and founder of One Small Thing, Edwina Grosvenor. In this episode, I have the privilege of speaking to Stephen Akpabio Klementowski. He's a former prisoner and now regional manager for the Students and Secure Environments team for the Open University. He's also an associate lecturer in criminology for the Open University and is also a PhD candidate. Listen as we unpack Stephen's remarkable journey, where he began studying whilst serving a 16-year prison sentence, and how engaging in education has enabled him to transform his life to where he is today.
My name is Stephen Akpabio Klementowski. I'm a regional manager for the Open University Students and Secure Environments team. What that means simply is that I manage the university's relationship with some 29 prisons in the south and the southwest of the country. I'm also an associate lecturer in criminology, again, with the Open University. And finally, I am a PhD candidate in criminology with a focus on prison education.
Amazing. Well, congratulations on embarking upon the PhD. And Stephen, can you tell me where your relationship with education started?
Yes. So I left school without achieving any qualifications. And so I've always been conscious of that, even though as a young person, I sort of tried to take it in my stride. So when I actually came into contact with education in any kind of meaningful way, was during a period of incarceration. In 2002, I was prosecuted and convicted of serious drug offences and sentenced to 16 years in prison. And it was during that period of incarceration that I had an opportunity to engage with education really for the first time. So my educational journey started in custody back in 2003.
Okay, and how did that manifest itself? Because I know that so many prisons are so different. How did you stumble across education in prisons, or was there a particular staff member who brought it to you? You know, what does that look like for our listeners who might never have stepped inside a prison?
Well, that's an excellent question, Edwina, because by going into prison, I certainly did not have any plans, aspirations, intentions to get involved with education. So I arrived in prison and was not looking out for educational opportunities, if I put it that way. So my negative experience of education as a young person added to that. So it was really by good fortune that I, as every other prisoner is required to, undertake my literacy and numeracy assessments. And these assessments are mandatory, and they provide the prison service with some indication as to each prisoner's educational level. So standard. And so I did my assessments, and I did actually quite well on these assessments.
And did that shock you?
Well, that was quite sort of significant, really, because well, first and foremost, it was the first sort of formal test was SAT.
Right.
and so he was interested in that I've done well. I could read and write, but it was the first time I'd sat down and done a test, and so from that perspective, it was quite significant. Well. And it could have just ended there, you know. I'd done my test, ticked the boxes, and I could have just returned back to myself. But education officer who administered the test was quite taken by how well I'd done, and that sparked a conversation. And that conversation led to initially actually formally sitting my GCSEs and gaining those GCSEs. It happened in record time as well, weeks.
Really? What? How many GCSEs did you sit?
I was at two.
Okay.
English and maths.
Right. And you got them done in a couple of weeks, which is completely unbelievable.
In a matter of weeks, I just clarify that, in a matter of weeks.
Yeah, that's still utterly astounding.
Yeah, things in prison don't work quite so quickly. But in a matter of weeks, I had got my GCSEs, and that was significant. That really was, because they were the first formal qualifications I actually had, and that did do something to my to my sense of confidence, to my sense just to the idea that, well, I've got a qualification.
And did you find it difficult? I'm interested in how you felt having sat them, and you got them quite quickly, and what were the sort of emotions that you felt? Were you sort of stunned or happy?
There were loads of emotions, really, to start with. I didn't welcome this focus on education, to begin with. I had to go up to the education department. I had to get into a classroom with much younger men than I was. I think at the time I was sort of my mid-30s. I had to sort of overcome what would have been, sort of stigma, the idea that I had no qualifications.
Right, so a little bit embarrassing, and, yeah. I guess you had to be quite humble.
Well, precisely that. But also, going up to education as opposed to having a job of some sort carries some sort of financial penalty as well. I know things have slightly moved on since I was in prison. I know certainly of one prison that now has a parity in pay for prisoners who are engaged in either education or work. But in most prisons, engaging in education carries a financial penalty in the form of lower wages.
Oh, I see. Right. So it's lower wages. You're not being paid to go to education, obviously. And probably there's a bit of a kind of, is it a bit embarrassing? Lots of people don't want to go because actually it's like I'm the tough guy, exactly. Or like...
there are two points there. The first point about pay is a significant reduction in pay. On average, perhaps, 70-odd% reduction in pay. So £2 going up to education since back in 2003-04. And £10, for the salary. So, for prisoners who are not financially independent, they must require some sort of financial support. Certainly the wages that you see don't help in terms of being able to afford, stamps, phone calls, just basic things. So it does put people off the fact that you're going to end up with less money at the end of the week. So that's one thing. But also, this idea that you're just starting your educational journey, not having any qualification, there's a huge stigma attached to that. And I eventually overcame that stigma. I realised I could do it pretty quickly. So I didn't, you know, I didn't expect to be involved in education for 18 years thereon.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to be in and out.
Exactly.
So did you find
when you were in the classroom with the other men, I'm interested to know what stage everyone else was at, because of course what some people might not know listening to this is that there's a lot of people in prison who can't read or write, mm-hmm. you know, and so therefore they fight having to fill in any forms or anything because they're just so embarrassed that they can't even write their own names. And that is kind of like quite amazing to think of in Great Britain in 2021. So when you were in that classroom, were there other people in there who literally were learning to write their names and 1 + 1, 2 + 2?
Edwina, not just in the classroom, on the wings, in my cell where I was doubled up with other people. Well, we know, I think from MOJ's own figures, I think something in the region of 42% of prisoners, as I alluded to earlier, have been excluded from school in some way or another. I was part of that cohort. Well, fortunately, I could read and write. But you're absolutely right to say the prisoners who arrive in custody without, you know, unable to read. I've had to read very personal communications and letters for prisoners who can't read them themselves. And that, you know, that's the height of embarrassment. You know, that's the, I can't explain how bad that is. When I was in prison, there were various schemes that involved sort of mentoring that prisoners would work with, where prisoners who could read, like I could, would work with other prisoners who were struggling with reading. And this particular scheme, it was run by a charity called, at the time, the charity was called the Shannon Trust, and the scheme was called Toe by Toe Scheme. And essentially, it was a very clever phonetical way of approach to reading, to learning to read, and it was very effective. So in a matter of weeks, you know, you could literally, you know, in as little as sort of 20 minutes to 30 minutes a day, in a matter of weeks, you could literally support somebody into being able to read basic sentences, construct basic sentences. So I was part of that project as well, for the very same reason. So by the time someone like me would end up in a classroom, we would have had to overcome all this stuff we've just talked about, and that's a big call for somebody who is only just one aspect of what you have to deal with, you know, being incarcerated. This is just one element of it. You know, you still have to deal with all the other issues that incarceration brings. So most people, unsurprisingly, don't want to touch it.
Absolutely.
Because they've got other things to be dealing with.
Exactly. And quite frankly, not that I know anything about male pride because I'm not a male, but I can imagine, yeah, that's just a huge sort of elephant in the room that is going on the whole time that people don't want to talk about. And what I do know from having worked in prisons for so long is that then that can eventually manifest in violence if someone is ashamed and doesn't want to do something. They'd rather kick off and distract so that they can leave the classroom and just not have to.
100%. Yeah. 100%. I mean, you find ways of not being there, find ways of not engaging, and that's not too difficult to achieve, you know, in prison setting. So there are issues. The men I worked with on this reading program, they all recognized that they recognized that this was a basic skill, and they actually, this is a skill that's required not just in prison, but actually when you get out as well. They then would, after a bit of persuasion, would then, you know, in order to empower people, you've got to bring yourself alongside. You can't do this from a top down. It can be done in a top down way. That approach just wouldn't work. What you need to do is to bring people, you need to come alongside people and make them feel comfortable to work with you. You know, you make them feel that you're not going to draw attention or highlight the whatever issues that they might have, you know, that you work with them quietly, confidentially, and that you work with them genuinely in an honest way, as long as they would put in their bit, you know, that's your part of the sort of contract, as it were. And as long as they put in their part of the contract, is the, you know, keeping to the rules and attend, you know, and engaging with what we're doing, then we would get through it. So you have, and that's why this scheme was particularly successful, because these prisoners weren't being supported by officers or members of staff or any other authority. They were being supported by their peers.
Yeah.
By those lads on the wings.
Exactly. And I think that's so powerful. And I'd love to see more and more of that sort of peer support and prisoners being trained up. I know quite a lot of that stuff does go on, clearly not now, sort of less so because of the pandemic, but it's such an important aspect of a healthy running of a prison, isn't it?
Well, you can extrapolate from that. One of the factors or features of the prison service that is often not discussed is the role of prisoners in actually supporting the delivery of services within prison. Yeah, I've talked about one scheme here, which is the reading scheme, but there are other schemes. The schemes like the listener scheme, a scheme where prisoners are trained by a Samaritan to provide sort of friendship, psychological support to other prisoners who might, you know, having a bit of time.
Yeah.
So that goes without, that is hardly ever discussed outside of prisons. But these are important roles. And so the notion of peer support is one that you can transfer, for example, right into the classroom, you know. So this work we did as mentors is done on the wings, in our rooms, in our cells. But that same concept can be transferred straight into the classroom, because you do have prisoners who have qualifications, you have prisoners who have skills, and you do have prisoners who are sort of in the process of acquiring these qualifications and skills in the learning path. And to me, then they are a real asset.
Absolutely, and can make the officers' lives easier, right? By sort of taking up some of the flack. We all know there aren't enough officers, and the officers that are there are overrun and overworked, and you know they've got too much on. So you know, I've always been amazed that the sort of peer support aspect isn't just like absolutely at the forefront of how prisons operate. But quickly going back to your studies, and so you galloped through your GCSEs, and then what came next?
Well, what came next was my sort of still resistance to any sort of further exploration of education as a meaningful pastime activity.
Yeah, you've got your two GCSEs and you're done.
Yes, exactly.
That's
it. I turned, you know, to get out the door. But then, you know, the fact that I had got these GCSEs so quickly really did spark a really strong conversation and debate between myself and the education officer, because it seemed I had the capacity to certainly engage in education, and it seemed I also had the time because I was there. So I wasn't doing anything else, as it were.
Yeah.
And so I had to, I've always prided myself as, you know, being someone who's rational, like to think through. I found it quite difficult to resist, you know, to continually resist this opportunity to get into education, not least because I demonstrated some ability. I just felt, because I couldn't justify my not wanting to engage, I reluctantly agreed. I thought, right, okay, so what's next? I'll do it quickly and I'll be gone. And A-levels were the first options, and I just said no, because I've always thought A-levels, quite rightly, it's a level 3 study that leads to university type.
Oh, right. So it's almost like a gateway drug. I'm not going to do the marijuana because it might lead on to something else. It's like, don't touch those A-levels. You'll be on the class A's like you are now in further education doing a PhD.
Oh, that's right. I could see the link, and I just said, no, I'm going to draw the line there. I certainly have no interest in the A-levels, and I'm not interested in peaceful, anything like that. So that would be that. Option of, you know, doing an access module with the Open University was sort of put to me, because that, again, access modules are sort of foundational. They add to the bridge between the level two qualifications with regional GCSEs. And if you wanted to go to university, the level four, you know, equivalent, year one, studying at university. So the access model acts as a bridge between these two levels of study. And but I didn't know, I know now, at the time, I didn't know these intricacies. But it was put to me that I having got my GCSEs, I was eligible for this access module. I did not worry about how to fund it, because it was being funded by grant, and also because it was a distant learning course through the Open University, I could do it in my own time. So I could go back to my jolly job on the surgery and then just work around my own time and gain this qualification if I wanted to. And that arrangement really did appeal to me.
Right.
It meant I would be responsible for my, basically, put, you know, my destiny was sort of in my hands.
Yeah, and I imagine feeling, you know, like you said, the embarrassment of going back to education when you're in your 30s, but then, you know, this allows you to be an adult, if you like, and you've got a job and you're managing your own time, and yeah, sort of makes more sense. But how did you stumble across the OU? Again, was that a member of staff who said, look, this is available to you in this prison?
Well, that's right. Well, I can't express how fortunate I was to be in that particular prison at that particular time, because, as I said, I view the role of the education officer as one of being a gatekeeper, and I certainly wouldn't have taken on that journey if I wasn't encouraged to do so, like on an individual basis. So it wasn't as if, you know, I was being consulted. I was having these debates and conversations about my future, as you know, and I can't stress how much I appreciate that. You know, looking back now, that for me, that was a positive and significant intervention.
Yeah,
you know, for me. So it was all down to members of staff. So did the GCSEs? I did want to do A levels, and then the other option was down the A-level path or down the Open University pathway through my access module. So as long as I successfully completed the access module, then the Open University would accept me. I would meet their eligibility criteria to begin a proper undergraduate degree with them. And so that was a massive, massive incentive.
Yeah,
for me to do.
But did it also feel a little bit lonely, because it's sort of, you know, and again, you'll have to paint a picture of how you managed to study, because you said you were sharing a cell. I doubt there was a desk. I haven't been into many cells that have got lovely writing desks.
Well, there's a small desk. Well, but obviously, you know, our team takes pride of place on that. So.
Yeah. And did you have a computer, you know, and did you have someone supporting you? So can you paint a picture of what your studying and your work life was actually like?
Okay. So, being in prison can have a sense of isolation, being in prison in itself anyway, so separated from friends, family, and so on. But as a student, even more so, I'm afraid, my 8 years in custody, I never had on my wing, or certainly on my landing, or indeed on my wing, did I ever have another prisoner who would be studying exactly the same subject that I was studying, or module I was studying. So they might have been studying the same subject, but they'd be studying a different module. So there's always that sense of isolation. But in a way, your companion is your materials. Your companion is your books and your study materials. So, indeed, you know, research has shown that actually being engaged in this, you know, study while in custody, certainly in terms of what you study, research has shown that one of the byproducts of this activity is your well-being. And the reason for that well-being is that I think it does compensate for the, you know, the loss of that social interaction you would otherwise have. Well, that just gets plowed into your studies and your course materials. And that's why, you know, students in prisons tend to do very well, given the restrictions that they often face. So for me, the sense of isolation is constant, something you learn to live with, and develop strategies of how you cope with it. And one of the strategies that worked really well for me was that I had my studies that would fill that void.
Yeah. What were the hours in the day where you used to study? I mean, you know, some people are morning people, some people are night people, but I guess you don't have too much of a choice in prison, yeah, depending on the regime and the servery and the other things that are going on. So what was your, like, working day and regime like?
Well, I tried to make the environment which is not designed for studying, punitive environment in some ways. I've had to sort of find ways of working with the environment. So prison is can be very noisy. It can be quite rowdy. And they're overcrowded in many instances. So you have to share cells with other people. So I would generally find that I found it best to study at night, where, you know, you've got lights out and everyone, you know, the place is a little bit more quiet than it would otherwise be. So that's after 10 p.m. normally. And I could be studying for 3, 4, 5 hours, depending. So my cellmate would be asleep, and I would be in the adjoining toilet, which my cell had. So we had this adjoining toilet where I would just sleep in the toilet with my books, with the lights on, but the lights off in the main cell.
And was he ever like, get off the toilet, turn the light off, what are you doing? Well, or was he quite accommodating? I guess you have to be accommodating.
Well, yeah, well, that's the thing. And this is partly why I still go into prison, because I think, you do have there's a camaraderie in there. It was a fellow prisoner that got me out of my state of shock in the first 3 months of being incarcerated, by simply just coming up and talking to me and just wanting to know if I was all right, because I haven't been speaking to anyone who could get out of my room or doing anything else. So there is a lot of support. I've talked about peer support already in more formal contexts, but there is this informal type of mentoring as well, and support that goes on.
Yeah. So generally speaking, your cellmate and others were supportive of what you were doing.
Well, my cellmate certainly was. Others maybe less so, but my cellmate certainly was. Yeah. It's difficult for prisoners to understand why, you know, someone who has a criminal record with all the implication that carries, even after release. You know, people do wonder why you want to spend your time. Why would you want to spend your time getting all these qualifications? If it worked. Because if it's for work, you can forget that. So there's a sort of negative attitude towards the whole notion of, you know, that sort of level of investment, you know, years.
Yeah, you'll never get a job when you get out because they'll find out you've got a conviction and, yeah,
precisely.
Why bother?
Precisely.
Get back to the drugs. So you managed to get you've got two master's degrees and you're doing a PhD. So were those masters, did you get them in prison?
Yes.
Both of them?
Yes.
My God.
Yeah.
And I say that because I'm doing a master's at the minute, so I know exactly what level of work is required. And I do sometimes think of you, actually, and think about what it would be like to be doing my master's sitting on a toilet in a prison cell. And so, I mean, a huge amount. So I'm just, yeah, totally inspired and in awe of what you managed to achieve. What were your master's in, can I ask?
Right. Well, so two things, really, I need to quickly say about my two masters. This is again where I think another intervention that is significant in terms of staff attitudes and staff expectations of prisoners' abilities and their capacities and things like that. Because I actually completed my undergraduate degree 2008, and that coincided with my recategorization to open conditions. That means that in 2008, I got recategorized from being a medium risk prisoner to a low risk prisoner. That meant I could go to an open prison, which are for low risk prisoners. So I actually went off to Spring Hill, which is an open prison in Aylesbury, Buckinghamshire. And it was there, having arrived, I went straight down to the education department to see if they had received my, because I had confirmation by letter from the university to say, congratulations, you achieved your Bachelor of Arts Honours degree in Social Sciences, but I hadn't had the certificate yet. So when I arrived in my open prison, went straight to the education department, and asked them if they had received it from the university. And yes, they had. And, you know, a drawer got pulled open and my certificate got pulled out. It was handed to me. I looked at it. It had my name. It had my qualification, Bachelor of Arts, Honours degree in Social Sciences. And I just stared at it. And, okay, got myself, you know, got my breath back, right? And I thought, thank you very much. And again, I just turned to walk out the door. I was still in the bit, you know, I actually had it in my hand now. But then again, I don't know how proper it is to actually name officers, but then again, the education officer at Spring Hill sort of called me back. And she said, but hold on a sec, Stephen. I thought, yeah. And she asked me the same questions along the same lines again. So what do you intend to do now? And I thought...
And you're like, God, everyone leave me alone.
Oh, yeah.
You're never happy.
Well, I just thought it was an odd question. I thought, what on earth do you mean? What do I do now? I'm in an open prison. There's a period where you have to demonstrate you should be there in terms of behavior, things like that. It's called a write-out period. I thought, what do you mean? I'm going to... obviously go through my light out period and then I'll become eligible for voluntary work and I'll go and do that and then I'll become eligible for, you know, sort of paid employment. And now I've got this degree, I've just thought that paid employment is going to be sort of, you know, the more prospects in that sense. And Ms. Gulliver said, right, so you've not thought about a postgraduate qualification?
No.
And I said, anyway, I couldn't possibly afford it. You know, and she said, well, you know that Oxford Brookes University is the local university here. We do have a contact there in the Department of International Relations. His name's Professor Higgins. Well, he actually has heard about you and he would like to sort of come in and meet you because there might be a possibility they might offer you something over there in terms of the master's. So that's how I got to end up at Oxford Brookes to do my first master's, which I then completed by 2009. And then, you know, I got offered an opportunity to do a PhD at that point. But I had 9 months to my release in 2010. and you know, PhD 4-year commitment. And I'd been in custody for such a long time. I wasn't quite sure how. So apprehensive. I had my concerns about being released back into the community. And so I just didn't want to take the funding and then not completely having been released and found out that, you know, I couldn't. And so I declined that offer, but then I got an offer to do another master's, a second master's, and this time in international law. So I opted for that option, and that's how I came to have complete two master's. By the time I got released in 2010, one in international relations and the other in international law.
That's absolutely amazing. And I guess, you know, at this point, we should really, you've already mentioned the importance of the OU and the ability and the importance of a university like Oxford Brookes to sort of, you know, to support people like you, but also highlighting the importance of those amazing members of staff that I think we don't hear enough about, because prisons get bashed left, right and centre, don't they? And, you know, people could very well think that all prison officers are one type of person and all prisoners are one type of person. But, you know, when you have those incredible people and they see the potential in someone and they're like, come on, I can see the potential in you. Yeah. You know, that is just so important. So I can't stress enough to the listeners.
That's why I name-checked Spring Hill. Because Spring Hill, and I don't know about practice in other prisons, but it's an open prison. I was the first prisoner who left. So in 2008, then, when I went off to do that first master's, I was the first ever prisoner from Spring Hill to go to Oxford Brookes. So that was one scholarship for me. And that turned out to be quite successful. But the point I want to make is about the senior management team at Spring Hill at the time, because, you know, everything's about risk factors and everything is about security and making sure that there's no issues with that. And I think it takes, you know, you need to have progressive governors who might appear to be brave and courageous and stick their neck out, because they did for me. Because if anything had gone wrong in that period of my release and temporary license to go to Oxford Brookes, then, you know, there would have been consequences for that senior management team. So I have to stress that and I have to say that. But today, some I don't know how many years on, I know that Oxford Brookes now has 10 scholarships, so they're about a year for prisoners at Oxford Brookes who might want to go over there to study with them.
That's brilliant.
That's something that should be commended, because this forms part of resettlement. Resettlement efforts. This is just going to make it 100% easier for prisoners to transit from custody into the community.
Exactly. And tell me just a little bit more now about the work that you do, and particularly that the work that you're doing going back into the prisons to help other people like you. And is that sort of nationally, or is it just a few prisons that you're doing that in?
Well, I got into that role through the Open University. So I joined the OU in 2015. I was released in 2010. I joined the OU in 2015 as one of four regional managers for the university's Student and Secure Environments team. And that team is responsible for supporting prisons in the delivery of OU study to their prisoners. I'm responsible for sort of 29 prisons in South and the Southwest of the country, and other colleagues of the others. So my role, that's my first role in prison, and I have a second role as an associate lecturer in criminology. So I teach students in prison as part of my overall student group. So again, not now during the pandemic, but I would go in and visit my students to deliver face-to-face tutorials to them. So those are the two bases in which I go to prison. But the former role is quite significant. So when I go in as a regional manager, even though my role does not necessarily involve, interacting with prisoners on a one-to-one basis or in groups, as my role is more managerial, I always, where the opportunity exists, I always take it to talk to prisoners in a one-to-one or in a group or as part of a group. And just to share my own journey, my learning journey with them. Because I think I often hear people say how, sort of prison is a waste of time. You know, people say that to me all the time. They say, well, prison is such a waste of time. And I have to, restrain myself in how I respond.
Yeah, because it doesn't have to be, right?
Well, yeah, because it wasn't a waste of time for me. Mm. But you have to be honest in that sense and try and get across and the idea of being sort of, having this passive period in your life or actually being active period sort of having some individual agency within, as small as that agency would allow within prison. So.
But it's kind of like, again, I think this comes down to character and drive and, the different things that we all have in us as individuals. And there was something within you that's inherent that allowed you to be motivated and a self-starter and to sit on the toilet every night and to, to do that learning, whereas some people might actually need much more support than you.
Well, I think it's understanding what's happening. So I think that's where sort of education has its trump card, because eventually you'll get to understand what's happening. So when I started with my studies, I had no idea. So I was still resistant to it. So I just, I didn't take a long view. I didn't project it forward and outward. I didn't appreciate where it could lead. I just thought, right, I need to do this bit and get it over and done with, and that'll be that. Right, so it's about, actually, I was thinking about this the other day, it's about what I see this invisible opportunities, a lack of perception. How can I take an opportunity that I can't even perceive? That's very difficult. And so, you begin to take the opportunity because you begin to perceive it more than that, you begin to imagine it more than that, you begin to make it happen in the activities that you're engaged with. It becomes something that's real. It's a bit like the shift in my sense of who I am. I clearly have a criminal record, to many people, that just puts me straight away in a particular category. I'm a criminal. I've got a criminal record. In my perception, nothing could be further from the truth. The truth is that I haven't offended since 2002, so almost two decades hence. The role I play within my community and within society is one that's positive. It's one that I am proud of. It's one that I will, more than happy to share, because I think that other people, might learn and take something away from it. It's exactly, I think, the way it should be. I've come through a process. I clearly have been able to take something that's positive from that process and build on it. But it's come full circle because I'm now giving back as much as I possibly can.
Exactly. And if we're talking about justice being done and the purpose of the justice system and the purpose of prison, you received your punishment. Whilst you were there, you were doing something positive, as you say, and now you're in the community and living your life as a law-abiding citizen. Do you, however, have moments where you're like, oh, it's a bit, I feel a bit guilty? I only ask that question not because I think you should feel guilty at all, but because other people that I've talked to who've been in prison sort of feel, because they've got a job now, that somehow they're still beating themselves up about the fact that these opportunities were afforded to them, but they came off the back of something very negative. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Well, yes, I think that's such a good point you touch on. And even when I arrived in prison, because I was kind of raw, the only way I put it, completely wrong place in my mind and in my head. I mean, I've sort of acknowledged it, but there is a massive, massive level of degree of shame that comes with incarceration. It's shameful, not just for me as a person, but for my wife, for my kids, for my family. It was shameful that another black, you know, young black man is, again, convicted for drug offences. So that, reinforcing those stereotypical views of black men. And so there's a shame, a real shame that comes from this. But what do you do with the shame? I mean, what, you know, that for me is what's, that's what allows me now not to beat myself about my previous experience, because I have felt that shame. With the support of a system that I still think is not necessarily designed to support the things that I was trying to achieve, but I actually was supported through my incarceration, certainly in terms of my study. And through that studies and my educational attainments, I've been able to reassess, reevaluate my sense of who I am, my sense of identity. And I think I would still beat myself if I felt that that label of being a criminal, you know, sort of still applied to me. I think that would be where that would come in. But it doesn't apply to me any longer. And it's not because I've just suddenly appeared. You know, it's because I've taken almost two decades to shift my understanding of who I am through the things that I do, not do, you know, through my actions. So it's a bit like, when I was involved in criminality, it's a chat about labor. When I'm not involved in criminality, it shouldn't attract that label.
Yeah, exactly. And it sounds to me, listening to you, it's that sort of absolutely what the word transformation is, that kind of like almost like a, I'm getting all symbolic now, but like a snake shedding its skin. It's kind of like, that was me, right? And I can appreciate that and say that, but that is not me now. And, you know, you can't keep beating yourself up about it, because, you know, if you do, then that's going to jeopardize.
Well, society's doing it anyway. Society does do that. I mean, I read on Twitter the other day, a lady who is not the offender or prisoner or whatever you want to frame it, but she's, her partner is in custody, and she was drawing attention to the flak she was getting simply because she's supporting him, and she's not just sort of saying, right, throw the keys away, or, you know, which, you know. And I read that, and I had to reach out to her to see how amazing she was.
Yeah.
As a person, because we lose the humanity of prisoners once we go through the gates, you know. But we are humans, and
And we love to judge, don't we? Yes. We love to judge, no matter who you are, and I think no matter what you're doing in life, and especially if you're active on Twitter, then there's many judges out there. Can I ask you what you're doing your PhD in? What are you researching? And because you'll be a doctor. Right.
Right. Yes. I mean, this is straight out from my experience. Because one of the things that I find really interesting is this idea that that prisons are, they have a dual function. So on the one hand, we recognise that prisons sentenced for punishment, they're associated with punishment. That goes without saying. But we also know that. It's often said that prisons have another function, and that is to sort of rehabilitate those prisoners in their care. And I find that quite interesting, because in my experience, we have a system that, you know, this is a really strong feature of our prison systems, that somebody like me, with no, you know, with nothing at all, completely zero, could arrive, you know, at the gates of prison, served their time, and then at the end of that, would have achieved these qualifications. So whatever else you want to say, well, that is an amazing feature of businesses. But then it's so difficult to do. It's so difficult to achieve qualifications. It's so difficult to get on to education. It's so difficult to get the information, advice, access, all of that you'd need to get involved. So it brought me to think, well, it would be interesting to explore how prisons actually achieve, if they do, this opposing twin objectives of being punitive on the one hand, but also rehabilitating prisoners on the other. Because I think it's a huge ask.
Right, that balance between punishment and sort of positivity, you give positive punishments? Yeah.
Well,
maybe you can. I mean, that's maybe a pod for another day.
Indeed, because the notion of punishment in and of itself is not the issue. The notion of punishment in and of itself is not the issue. So yes, you know, you'll find that most prisoners accept, you know, consequences come from actions. And so, you know, and I think one purpose of prisons, you know, the ability to incapacitate offenders, that works because you get incapacitated and you can't commit any offences while you're in there. Certainly in terms of members of the public, so it does serve that role. But then, you know, how do you then transit, move from there into a situation where you're now saying, oh, you know, conditions are like this, overcrowded, so on and so on and so on, without having to spell it out. So the idea of punishment in the loss of liberty through as incapacitation, fine, I think most prisoners accept that logic. But then does that mean everything else that comes with being in prison? I think that's where we need to look and ask ourselves if what we hope to achieve in terms of rehabilitation, reducing reoffending, we have to ask ourselves, how likely is that possible in these types of environments?
Yeah, absolutely. Stephen, I just want to say such a big thank you for talking to me today. It is February half term. You have children to get back to. I do too. But you have totally and utterly, and I don't mean to sound corny because I'm sure a lot of people say you're inspiring, but you've inspired me to get through the rest of my masters with the way that you tackled and sort of went headlong into your education. So thank you so much. Good luck with all your work with the Open University. A shout out to Oxford Brookes and to Spring Hill. What year was it, Spring Hill?
Spring Hill was 2008 to 2010.
Okay, senior management team, Spring Hill, 2008 to 2010. And also to your lovely wife who got you through some difficult times, I'm sure. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Links relevant to this episode can be found in the pod notes below. If you enjoyed listening, we would love it if you would subscribe. Also, rate, review, and best of all, share this episode. Justice is produced for One Small Thing by the London Podcast Company.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.